afternoon.
Good afternoon, Justice Howland. I rise briefly before the argument to introduce my friend and colleague, Mitchell Lowenthal, from the Cleary Gottlieb firm.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, Carmela Keener on behalf of the plaintiff below appellant, David B. Chef Profit Sharing Plan, I rise to introduce my colleague and co-counsel, Samuel Rosen of Wexler Harwood.
Thank you. And welcome to the court. And when I turn on the clock, it'll count down your total time. And when you get to the yellow light, you'll be into the time you reserved. And you can keep arguing, but you won't have any time left.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Samuel Rosen of the firm Wexler Harwood, and I represent the plaintiff in this action. This derivative action is based on the alleged intentional dereliction of duty or conscious disregard of responsibilities by the members of Citigroup's board of directors and its relevant committees. The alleged dereliction of duty arises from their failure to discuss and take corrective action at board or relevant committee meetings of systemic and continuous Citigroup misconduct.
And do you agree that the board had no actual knowledge of this conduct?
Neither the board nor the audit committee nor the public affairs committee ever discussed the conduct at its meetings.
No, I understand that. So, but is there anything in the record to indicate that any single director knew what was going on?
There's nothing in the record to indicate that, Your Honor, and I submit that that is what the problem is in this case, that there wasn't a system in place by which the directors or the committee members did learn of the misconduct. And
have you alleged what that particular system should be?
I've alleged that in the primary instance, the charge of the audit committee was to determine risks to Citigroup. There was a man who was the head of global risk management at Citigroup who had written openly to another senior executive of Citigroup to say that there was a franchise risk to Citigroup in connection with a certain transaction with Enron.
So is the system to monitor all correspondence?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
What is the system?
The system should be, if there's a chairman or a head of global risk management, the audit committee ought to suggest or ought to ask that officer, are there any risks to the corporation that we, the directors, ought to know of? Had they asked that question, they didn't have to know anything was wrong with Enron, and they didn't have to know anything was wrong with any of Citigroup's customers. All they had to do was ask, is there a risk out there we should know about? Had they asked the head of global risk management whether there were any risks, I suggest that it's a logical inference that he would have said, we've got this risk with Enron. And I say that it's a logical inference because he had put it in writing. He had put it in writing to somebody else, and it's a logical inference that he would have told the audit committee member who asked him or another board member who asked him.
Well, is it equally logical to think that if this person perceived there was a risk, he would have mentioned it, whether anyone asked him a question or not? I mean, you bring information to these people, and supposedly they're going to do something with it.
And if he brought it to their attention, they didn't do anything about it.
Well, that's a separate question. So far the record seems to indicate nobody knew about this on the audit committee. Is that right?
That's correct.
But my question to you is, if you've got somebody doing risk management,
right,
you would assume they would notify you of a risk whether or not anyone asked the question.
I'm not, I don't believe, Your Honor, that the audit committee, that the board can leave it to management to come to them. I think that they have to ask the relevant questions, that that's their job as the representative of the shareholders in dealing with management. It's their obligation to go to management and ask the relevant questions. Otherwise, the board is in a don't ask, don't tell position, and the corporation is in a don't ask, don't tell position. They're going to leave it to management to come to them. An audit committee exists to ask the relevant questions.
Was there any reporting system of any kind in place by which management had a responsibility to report information to the audit committee?
At this point, I don't know that, Your Honor. I just know that it didn't come to their it wasn't discussed at a meeting. So if it did come to their attention, they didn't act on it, which they should have. And if they didn't, and if they didn't ask, then they didn't get the answer. Whether there was a specific reporting system in place, at this point, I don't know. I know what the audit committee's charter instructed them to do. And among the things it instructed them to do was to ask, was to deal with risk management of the corporation.
Do you agree that your underlying action is properly characterized as a Caremark oversight type of action?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Now, tell us why demand was excused on this particular board as it existed at the time of the complaint.
Because the good faith of the directors is challenged due to their, as Chancellor Chandler put it in his first Disney opinion, and as this court referred to in the sustaining the decision after trial, that there was a "we don't care about the risks" attitude at the board, which is alleged in the complaint. And
now, but how do we identify the point in time? One of the difficulties with oversight actions is they proceed over a period of time, and the composition of the board may change. So in the normal course, in the normal derivative case, you'd identify an action that occurred, you'd attribute it to the board, and you'd say why the board was interested. How do we make that connection between what you're alleging was a lack of oversight at a particular point in time and a majority of the incumbent board at the time of the complaint being unable to respond?
Because a majority of the board at the time we brought the action had been members of the board during the transactions complained of. In 2001, when Mr. Bushnell, the head of global risk management, sent his email to another vice president of the company, a majority of the board at the time that the complaint was brought were members of that board. And I just want to focus on what it was in that particular email, as in addition to all the others, that he said. Mr. Bushnell, the director of global risk management, wrote to the head of Citigroup's global corporate and investment bank that he, Mr. Bushnell, had refused to sign off on a particular Enron deal because the accounting was aggressive and a franchise risk to us if there is publicity. As I said before, nobody had to ask anything specific about Enron to ferret out that the fact that there was this global risk, that there was this, franchise risk to Citigroup. It was there. It was on the surface. It was available to anyone just asking the question, what are the risks out there? Anything we should know about? There were numerous other emails, statements by senior members of Citigroup's management that also should have come to either the Audit Committee's attention or the Public Affairs Committee attention if they had asked the right questions of the of senior management. But the critical question of are there any risks out there indicates the almost lack of interest of the board. And I don't know why they didn't ask it, but at this point I don't think I have to know why. That can come out in discovery. The logical inference is that they didn't ask the relevant questions. As this court said in the recent Disney opinion, even though we're not suggesting conflicting self-interest of the board, they engaged in misconduct that's alleged to be more culpable than simple inattention to be informed of all the relevant facts.
And why is that?
Because they didn't ask the simplest of questions. In his decision in Gutman against Wong, Vice Chancellor Strine pointed to a situation where there may be a situation where facts are buried, that the board can't find it, maybe even accountants can't find it, can't hold the board liable for that. Fair enough. But here, it's right on the surface. You don't have to dig. You don't have to work. You just have to ask the relevant questions that an audit committee that's charged with finding corporate risk, you just have to ask the head of global risk management, what are the risks out there?
Well, in this case, if I follow you, the audit committee didn't ask the question. Therefore, if the board had said to the audit committee, is there any reason for concern, the audit committee would say no because the audit committee hadn't asked the right questions. Is that correct?
The audit committee not having asked the right questions, that's correct, Your Honor. The rest of the board would not have known about the risk, but they failed, the rest of the board, when establishing the audit committee, should have established guidelines which would have enabled the audit committee to determine the whether there were risks out there. And it seems to me that a properly functioning board in the charter of the audit committee would have put in a provision to the effect of ask the head of global risk management, are there any risks out there? So even though the board didn't know about it, the board was more than negligent. The board was guilty of more than simple inattention, because it didn't even tell the audit committee to ask the relevant questions, and the simplest and most relevant questions.
So we have this breach of fiduciary duty that's attributable to the majority of the board based upon the way they set up the audit committee. Is that your contention?
They set it up in such a way that they couldn't find out the most relevant underlying answers to the most fundamental underlying questions that an audit committee should be checking. Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And it's essentially a we don't care about the risk attitude, because if the board is not, if the audit committee isn't checking on, isn't able to ferret out what the head of global risk management calls franchise risks, and the board hasn't told them to check with the head of risk management what risks are there out there, what has the board done to assure itself that there are no major risks to the corporation?
Well, help us understand where you see the law going if your position prevails. CareMart seems to suggest you have oversight responsibilities, you have oversight committees. And this particular board established an oversight committee. Apparently, the oversight committee either didn't do its job or its job description was improper. And now you want to translate that into a breach of fiduciary duty for the board. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because it goes to the core of corporate oversight. It's not, you know, there's a transaction here, a transaction here that we didn't pick up. This goes to the core of Citigroup's business.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes, ma'am.
Am I correct that you're not alleging that there had been other problems in the past that the audit committee hadn't brought to the board's attention, and therefore the board had some reason to know that the audit committee wasn't functioning appropriately, right? In other words, this is not... They were warned. They knew that their systems weren't working because something happened 4 years ago, and they just said, "So what?" This came to light all after the fact, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not alleging that the board was on notice that there was something wrong with the audit committee's procedures prior to this.
Okay, and that's I'm having some trouble with this because if the board has set up a committee that is supposed to be an oversight type committee, and nothing has happened yet to warn the board that this oversight committee isn't functioning particularly well, why should the board members have assumed that their committee wasn't going to function properly?
I'm not saying that they should have assumed that the committee wasn't functioning properly. I'm saying that for the rest of the board, in establishing the committee, they didn't establish guidelines that would have under the CareMark requirements, they wouldn't have established proper guidelines for the committee that would have enabled the committee to find the problems that ultimately arose. Had someone had the board said in its charter, make sure you talk to the head of global risk management because your job is ferreting out risk.
Well, I don't want to use up all of your time, but let's make a different analogy. Let's suppose that the board's concerned about fire, and the board decides they ought to have smoke detectors, and the board has no reason to know that the smoke detectors don't function, but they also haven't checked to see if anybody else is testing the smoke detectors. Then we have a fire. Under your theory, is the board breaching its fiduciary responsibility because it didn't make sure that someone tested the smoke detectors?
I would say that the board would have exercised its fiduciary duty had it checked, had it purchased, or had it caused the corporation to purchase the smoke detectors from a legitimate company that the board had determined had made properly running smoke detectors in the past. Here, it's as if the board went to a startup smoke detector company and said, we're going to buy smoke detectors from you, and you know what, we think they're going to work because your company has a nice name or we like the color of your eyes.
I don't want to use up all your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
May it please the Court. In Rails, this Court held in an oversight context that the plaintiff has to establish more than a mere threat of directorial liability. There must be a substantial likelihood to surmount the difficult standard of 23.1. The complaint is familiar to this Court. It's very similar to the one that the Court affirmed the dismissal of several years ago. And if you look at Appendix B1 onward, you'll see a black line that shows the similarities. The allegations that the board failed to prevent loans to Enron and what happened there is no real different than the prior complaint. It just still doesn't survive, nor do the allegations relating to the fact that there were buy recommendations on WorldCom and Enron. When the new plaintiff the same attorneys marked up the complaint and did something different. They made a 220 demand using the tools at hand, as this court has said over and over again they should do. But in doing so, they haven't come up with anything substantially different. There's nothing in the 220 inquiry that found any involvement of the board in the wrongdoing. They showed no knowledge of the board of any of the alleged wrongdoing. And there's nothing alleged that would disable this board from acting. Your question, Justice Holland, about the audit committee made clear, there are six members of the 17-member board sitting on that committee. There's nothing been shown to establish non-conclusory facts that they did anything wrong. But if they did, that's 6 out of 11. You still have 11 who are not disabled from looking disinterestedly at a demand. We had a concession before the Vice Chancellor by my friend that Citigroup is one of the most regulated entities in the world. And the complaint references these two committees that Your Honor spoke with Mr. Rosen about. There is no description of the systems that are concededly in place or any identification of a defect in those systems. Indeed, the 220 demand did not go to the systems and to how they worked or how they didn't work. And we know that there is a system that addressed this specifically because, as my friend Mr. Lowenthal points out, we have a head of global risk management. That is a system. The board created that position to perform that function. And managers know where to go when they have problems. And certainly in today's atmosphere, they know they go to the board of directors or to the audit committee if they have something to report. This manager, I don't know what the facts are beyond that, but the deal went forward, presumably was satisfied after further inquiry that his assessment was not, in fact, an accurate one at that point in time because the deal went forward. And the memo comes, by the way, after a good deal of the work with Enron had already passed. If there's something that he should have reported and he failed to report it, that is a failure at a level far below the board of directors of the company.
So there's nothing about the actual systems in the record other than we know people hold certain titles?
No, sir. Justice Richley, there is not a description of the system or its deficiencies. The systems, in essence, are described in part in the Form 10-K and reports filed by the company. Certainly the regulatory overlay, Mr. Rosen, because of his prior statement to the Court of Chancery, is familiar with. It is a financial services institution. This is the largest in the United States and the second biggest in the world, is highly regulated, has many systems in place, has people with titles like Global Risk Manager. If they fail to input into the system of reporting, then there may be a problem that needs to be addressed, but that is not a culpable director misconduct or conscious disregard of risk. They are acutely aware of risk. They have people with names related to risk involved. So that's part of the system in place. Caremark doesn't require a perfect system. In rereading former Chancellor Allen's words, it requires a reasonable one, and Your Honors will tell us over the years what that consists of. But having a concession that we have a system in place, it seems to me incumbent on a plaintiff who is arguing that directors are disabled from disinterested consideration of demand must show a defect in the system, must plead how the system failed, or as Justice Berger pointed out, that it's like the one bite rule with the dog, that they were on notice that there was a defect in the system they'd put in place, however wonderful it looked. Something slipped through before, and now they needed to do something to correct that. And there would be allegations about the corrective efforts not being sufficient to correct the problem. That is a more detailed 220 inquiry. That is a more detailed investigation, as the court inquired in the prior argument this morning, that you may or may not choose to require of plaintiffs. Whether or not they are required to surmount 220 is one question. They certainly, to meet the 23.1 burden of particularized non-conclusory facts, have to do something more than was done here. What happened here is the amendment of the prior complaint to say, instead of the board failed to prevent this stuff from happening, is the board failed to have systems in place to prevent it. That's a conclusory statement, especially when there are, in fact, systems, people with titles that indicate the existence of the system who are actually looking at the things they're supposed to be looking at, the global risk managers looking at risk.
So your position is that they put a reasonable system in place, and there's no evidence in the record to give any indication that they were aware this system wasn't working.
Precisely, Justice Holland. That is absolutely our position. And if, as I said, there's a failure at a lower level, that needs to be dealt with differently than by saying that directors are disabled from consideration of a demand. What we have here is a system in place, and what we want to have, committees set up to consider these matters and committees that meet. What plaintiffs would do here is to tell you that because they used the tools at hand the second time around, that there's some guaranteed immunity from dismissal, because one of two things happens. Either there's a disclosure that the board was aware of it, in which case they didn't act, and supposedly, I guess the argument's then it's a red flag under Alice Chalmers, or if the board didn't discuss it, then there's some thing that gets them over 23.1 for having an inadequate system in place. And Delaware law, of course, doesn't dole out failure to supervise lightly in the 23.1 context, and it certainly can't do so on a heads I win, tails you lose basis, which is what they would say. They're to be congratulated for using the tools at hand, but the inquiry, as I understood from 1996 onward, when the phrase was first used by former Chief Justice Vesey, was to do the inquiry so that only the meritorious complaints that will meet the tough pleading standards get filed. And it means that many times there will be an inquiry and nothing will be found that will merit going forward. The fact that one does it and then goes forward all the time, I don't believe is what the court said the public policy should be. And here they found nothing to indicate board involvement. This asked the question point, I think everything points to the board having asked the question, the audit committee asked the question insofar as they set up people and procedures to get them that information. If those people failed, maybe they should be replaced, but that's not a board-level failure. If, in fact, the board did not ask the question, however, that leads to the alternative ground that the court could affirm upon, and that is 102b7. Their failure to ask that question would be a pure duty of care problem. And like the other allegations here, there's nothing that would implicate a lack of loyalty or some intentional wrongdoing by any director. At most, they didn't look at a piece of paper, failed to ask a question, do the types of things that 102b7, because the shareholders...
Let's go back to the Rails part of your argument that you mentioned earlier, which is the composition of the board at the time of the complaint. As I understand your argument, the undisputed record is that the audit committee didn't know about this problem, and we're being told the audit committee didn't know about it because it didn't ask the questions. So that's a failure of the audit committee. And what the record also shows, there were 11 people who weren't on the audit committee who also didn't know about the problem. And since the 11 out of 17 constituted a majority of the board, if the real allegation is attributable to the audit committee, then you have a majority that could respond. But your opponent is saying the problem is that the way the board set up the audit committee, it didn't have the right guidelines. What's in the record that would tell us the guidelines or the responsibilities of the audit committee?
There's nothing other than the charter of the audit committee that I'm aware of in the record, Your Honor, and the public pleadings or disclosures make clear the audit committee's broad penumbra of activity. The charter does not say thou shalt ask global risk manager or anything specific like that. I'm unaware of any charter of any company that does something like that. And managers know where to go when they have smoking guns. They come forward. That's what triggered the disclosure about what was going on at Enron. An employee comes forward and says there's something wrong here. And we don't know that they didn't ask, by the way. The inference we're supposed to somehow infer, because the board and the audit committee weren't aware of it, that they didn't ask this global question, is there anything we should be aware of? You could just as easily infer that an audit committee sitting today would ask managers, is there anything we should be aware of? I've sat in such meetings where people say, is there anything we should know about that we're not asking about? They may just as well have asked the question and not gotten the answer, and that is not a board fault either. You cannot, on this record, there is no credible factual allegation that is non-conclusory that they did not ask. And this ask issue comes up in briefs. It's not in any pleading. The failure to ask if it occurred could just as easily be presumed to be an incorrect fact as a correct fact. We don't have a pleading that says that. unless the court has any other questions, there's a reference to this New York case and the timing and the chronology in the reply brief that they throw in is wrong, suggesting that a settlement was reached after the motion to affirm was denied. In fact, the settlement was publicly disclosed in the company's 10-K in February. Apparently, they didn't read it, but it was around subsequent to the Court of Chancery, but prior to their filing of a brief in the Supreme Court. So,
Are you going to be arguing at some point in time that it's res judicata or that they're collaterally stopped from going forward because the settlement's been approved?
We will be in a position where if the settlement papers are sent out to shareholders with a notice that they will have an opportunity to appear and argue. And if another court were to approve a settlement that included these issues, just as Delaware courts approve settlements of matters that include actions elsewhere, that could be the effect of it.
Well, what's the effect going to be on whether this case becomes moot while we have it under advisement?
I don't believe in the 90 days that your honors generally use for consideration that there's any chance under the timetable that that could happen.
And New York courts aren't as quick as we are.
No, rarely are courts anywhere in the land as quick as this court, and this is not a case where we have something credible that says that a majority of this board is incapable of disinterestedly considering a demand, and I respectfully submit that the court should affirm the ruling by the Court of Chancery.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this is not a heads I win, tails you lose situation. This is not a situation where we are seeking to second guess a board on its conduct. This is a major one for this corporation, and the system in place didn't work for a monumental problem for this corporation. Regardless of the titles of people, the committees that were set up, the system didn't come up with the biggest problems that some of the biggest problems this corporation ever faced, which ultimately cost them in settlement of litigation billions of dollars.
Other than the charter, is there any description of the system in the record?
No, Your Honor, there isn't, because the description of the system is that the charter wasn't followed. The technical description of the system is the charter says the board that the audit committee is to examine risk. The audit committee didn't find the biggest risk facing the company as understood by its head of global risk. To the extent that there are other problems with the system, I submit that that is an issue for discovery that we couldn't know at this point, even having used the tools of a 220 demand.
So the record is here, at least as in terms of what's alleged, a single instance of inability to discover wrongdoing.
No, Your Honor. If I may suggest, there are many other issues that were missed that are described in the complaint, but this was the main one, and the fact that they didn't discover this one is an indication that neither the audit committee nor the public affairs committee, in practice, not in the details of its charter, but in practice, didn't do what it was supposed to do. And the system didn't work. And if I just may take one moment, say.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Rosen, you're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank
you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.